Greetings and salutations, darklings. We are Chell and Tori, and welcome to Vampires Ruined My Life.
Tonight, we're going to discuss the 1987 cult classic vampire movie, Near Dark.
Near Dark stars Adrian Pastar as Caleb Colton. Adrian was not initially interested in Near Dark. He is from the city and he didn't know anything about the Southwest culture or genre films. But director Catherine Bigelow and the clout of the other cast members brought him in. Pastar is best known for his roles in Heroes and as the voice of various superheroes in the Marvel animated universe. It also stars Jenny Wright as May. Wright started acting and modeling in her teens, even posing for Salvador Dali. However, tired of Hollywood politics and bullshit behavior, Jenny abruptly decided to retire in 1998. In a 2021 interview, Jenny Wright stated that her favorite role was of May in Near Dark.
Nice. Lance Henriksen plays Jesse Hooker. Henriksen also plays the lead in Chris Carter's non-X-Files show Millennium, where he plays Frank Black, the not psychic, but sort of psychic detective. He kind of Will Graham's things. And so we're supposed to believe that he is just figuring it out by knowing the way a serial killer thinks. But it does feel like he's psychic. So me and Chris Carter have a beef, which you can hear all about on my podcast, I Want to Rewatch, where we are also watching Millennium along with X-Files. Henriksen also has a long career, and one of his notable roles is playing Bishop Al in the Aliens franchise. Bill Paxton plays Severin. This is not Bill Pullman, whom I always confuse him with. I always get those two mixed up every single time.
It happens.
He did appear in the movies Titanic and Twister, the latter of which had a very killer soundtrack that I used to love and honestly should listen to again because I remember it was pretty awesome. Paxton got his start with films like Weird Science, and he plays good old boy Private Hudson in Aliens, and he starred in the HBO original series Big Love.
R.I.P. good buddy.
Oh, I didn't know he had died.
He did.
Yeah. Oh. And then Jeanette Goldstein plays Diamondback. She looked super familiar to me, but she's just been in a lot of stuff. Notably, she was also in Titanic. And where I think I recognize her from is she played a science officer in the movie Star Trek Generation. So I think that's why her face was familiar to me.
She's best known as Private Vasquez from Aliens. So fine. Oh, and then we have Joshua John Miller as Homer. Though he has retired from acting, Joshua Miller was well known in another teen cult classic film, Teen Witch, as obnoxious brother Reggie. He also has a familial connection to the other vampire film of 1987, as he is the half-brother of Jason Patrick from The Lost Boys. Miller currently writes for television and co-created the series Queen of the South.
Nice. The movie also features Marcy Leeds as Sarah Colton and Tim Thomerson as Loy Colton. We looked at their IMDb. They don't have a ton of credit, so you might know them from other things, but there was nothing in there that seemed particularly notable.
Catherine Bigelow and her writing partner Eric Red decided to write two scripts on spec, the latter of which became Near Dark. Bigelow describes Near Dark coming out of a hybrid of Western and horror and what that might look like. She saw them as a nice fusion with vampires because, like Westerns, vampires are romanticized. Though inspired by Dracula, Bigelow decided to remove more gothic elements like staking and religious iconography. She wanted her vampires' rules to be very clean and straightforward. Bigelow was able to retain her directorship because she wrote the script on spec. So now it was time to find the funding. Executive producer Ed Feldman agreed to her terms, but in traditional sexist Hollywood style, told her she could only work pre-production and would have 3 days directing. And if he thought she was falling short, like, he would totally replace her. Other EP, Stephen Jaffe, had every confidence in her and called her one of the hardest working directors he's ever met, even going so far as to storyboard the film herself. She obviously proved herself, and this was her very first solo directorial debut.
Nice. Yeah, I like the idea that it's kind of based on a Western, because I feel like that makes the feeling of the movie, like the tone, make a lot of sense.
Yeah. And she, I mean, this is like the very first vampire Western.
Sure.
So it set a whole new genre up. The marketing, as you might have guessed, was absolutely awful and treated without finesse. And Near Dark was released on the heels of Lost Boys, which had many big budget powerhouses behind it in like movie studios and money and just, you know, like a much bigger marketing. So not that like it's necessarily a competition because they weren't directly competing with each other. Lost Boys was released in July and Near Dark was released on October 2nd, 1987. Mm-hmm. But only in 262 theaters, grossing $635,789.
Very specific number. Very
specific.
That
is a very specific number. Oh, that's like on its opening weekend. So it went on to make $3.4 million below its $5 million budget. It received mixed to positive reviews and eventually became a true cult classic. Now, a quick aside. Narrator Chelt, that's me, has an eye-twitching pet peeve regarding the abuse of the term cult classic. I'm semi-purist. The film needs to be obscure and underground at most, or a box office bomb with a limited release at least. It's difficult for films to reach cult classic status these days, but with the advent of straight-to-streaming films, I think they're making a slow but steady comeback. Anyway, Near Dark, I'd make a hard case for this film being a cult classic. Because, you know, it found its audience after the fact.
Sure. Yeah.
The score was done by Tangerine Dream, a German-based band specializing in ambient electronica. They were pioneers of electronica and scored over 60 film soundtracks, most heavily in the 1980s. The original soundtrack, which got me obsessed with fantasy soundtracks, especially those of the 1980s, was Tangerine Dream and their score for the theatrically released version of Legend. Near Dark has a haunting, restrained quality to it, so as not to bombard the audience with overly fantastical scents. It's really lovely.
Nice. So the movie opens, and it's dusk in small-town Oklahoma. Caleb Colton drives into town, and he meets some pals for drinks. They spot an attractive young woman holding an ice cream cone. Caleb walks over to her and asks for a bite and says, "I'm just dying for a cone." And of course, May, who is pale, she is pretty, she has very pale skin, she looks a little suspicious. She hones in on the words bite and dying and kind of teases him about those words, like, oh, you'd really die for it, that kind of thing. Her name is May, and she tells him that she's from Sweetwater, Texas, but she's staying with friends in a nearby trailer park, and then she asks Caleb for a ride home. En route to the trailer park, she tells Caleb to stop and they get out of the truck. She converses whimsically about the deafening sounds of the night and the light of a star taking a billion years to reach the Earth. Caleb says that he's never met a girl like her before. May says, "You know why you've never met a girl like me before? Because I'll still be here when the light of that star gets down to Earth." And then they start kissing, and while he's kissing May's neck, Caleb professes that sounds like fun. He wishes he could be there, too. And May replies, "Maybe." Caleb then takes May to meet his horse, Diesel. But the horse does not like her, apparently has an aversion to certain supernatural creatures that we'll learn May might be. And she's like, "Oh, horses always hate me." And he's like, "Oh, guess so." He's kind of like, okay, that's weird. But he's not super weirded out by it. And then he lassos May and they play tug of war. And he notes that she's physically stronger than him.
After a bit of flirting and kissing, May suddenly demands that he take her home, as she is due by dawn. Despite Caleb's claims that dawn is a long way off, she becomes increasingly frantic. On the ride home, he stops the truck and tells her that he will get her home, but first, she has to kiss him. Gross, Caleb.
Yeah, it's one of those like 1980s, like cute guy things that was really popular to like sort of not harass, but kind of like.
If that happened to me, I would fear for my fucking life.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing is like it's always played off in 80s movies as this cutesy move. Like, I'm going to stop the car and you have to kiss me before I start it again. And it's like supposed to be cute and adorable, but yeah, it's gross and not cool.
As the two kiss passionately, May bites Caleb's neck. With blood on her lips, she abruptly leaves the truck and runs for home just as the sun starts to rise. Caleb begins to follow on foot, but quickly gives up and returns to find his truck won't start. On his walk home through the fields, Caleb's skin begins to smolder as the dawn rises. He is weak and stumbling when his little sister spots him nearing the family farm. She alerts her father, a livestock vet, tending to his animals, and the two watch as a Winnebago RV with darkly tinted windows careens into the field where a figure opens the door and pulls Caleb inside before speeding off. Caleb's father and sister are left hopelessly chasing after them. Inside the RV, May's companions prepare to kill Caleb, but stop when May throws herself atop Caleb and reveals that she has turned him.
Yeah, I was confused, like, why they grabbed him. Like, why would they grab him if they didn't already know that he was on his way to becoming a vampire? Because I thought that's why they picked him up.
Oh, no, I think they were going to make May finish the job.
Yeah, that makes sense. But I was just really confused when they're like, oh, he's turning. Like, they were confused by it. And I'm like, isn't that why you grabbed him? Like, what's going on?
So the RV pulls into an old hangar before everyone tucks in to sleep for the day.
Yeah, I think vampiring in an RV is my new life goal. Like, I just think that's awesome.
Yeah.
It's smart. It's a really clever way to travel around and be able to, like, hide from the sun.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, Loy Colton, Caleb's father, is recounting the events that occurred that morning. It's been over 4 hours since his son was kidnapped before his very eyes, and he's understandably upset at the lackluster response from the law. Like, no one is helping. They're like, well, he's a, you know, the standard police line. Like, he's an adult. He's allowed to leave. That night, May is arguing to keep Caleb, and she's promising the other vampires that she'll teach him the ropes. The vampire who turned her, a child vampire named Homer, doesn't believe that May can do it. And Severin accuses Homer of being jealous. And then Severin, who is also kind of a jerk, states that if Caleb fucks up, it's their asses on the line. Diamondback corrects him, telling May that she will be the one accountable for Caleb. So she's taking full responsibility for this guy. And so their leader, Jesse, decides to give Caleb 1 week to prove that he belongs with them.
As this is the first scene we initially witness the vampire family dynamic, I'll go into a little bit of back history. Bill Paxton was the first to get his hands on the script and called Lance Henriksen to tell him about it. Lance was really skeptical, but Bill insisted he needed to read it too. And once he did, Lance was just as excited to be part of the project. Separately, Lance, Bill, and Jeanette Goldstein were cast, and neither realized it until they reunited for a casual dinner. So that's kind of like, they're like, wait, you're cast in this? Yeah, I remember that vampire script that you sent me over? Yeah, I got cast in it too. And then Jeanette's like, wait a minute, is this the same vampire film? They're like, oh my God. Catherine called up James Cameron to ensure that he was fine with it because these three had just been very recently part of his big Aliens franchise and were all in it. Catherine liked the idea of these three actors who had gone through another production, Aliens, and became so close from it as the core of these vampires. And I honestly think that's super clever. A lot of this film worked based completely on the dynamic the actors had to build up during production. So they would go through many improv routines to really develop and deepen the relationship of the vampires. Like, they would run drills and essentially have these rehearsal boot camps in character where they would do the blackout rooms. Like, so they'd go, okay, quick, you know, here's some spray paint, some tape, some fabric, and some foil. They would like time themselves of how quickly they could shut out the light of like their hotel rooms.
Oh, fun.
Yeah. So Lance and Bill would even like take off on road trips in character, once driving out to Tombstone and having a conversation along the way. Like, they were going to go visit the graves of like their old dead friends from the West, you know? So like the whole way. Lance Henriksen is kind of like one of those like very seriously method actors,
mm-hmm.
like to the point of like, you know, like I would chuckle at it, you know, you're like, okay.
Yeah, man. He is.
Calm down.
Takes it, very seriously. You can tell too, just watching Millennium, and he's very good at what he does. Like, it works for
very
him,
good.
For sure.
Yeah, it works for him. Yeah. But like, he even like picked up a hitchhiker apparently, like during production, and was like talking to him as if he were Jesse Hooker, and like with like the goal of like freaking this guy out. It's just like, oh my God.
Yeah, that's going a little far.
So, but I mean, you really feel the chemistry, like the familial chemistry between especially like those three vampires. So, and they equally are my favorite characters.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
So the vampires burn their RV because obviously it was seen by Caleb's father. And so they can't keep driving it around. The police might know to look for it. And Severin steals a vintage station wagon to replace it. They drive to Kansas and find a warehouse to park in before sunlight so they can kind of hide. And then they disperse to hunt once it's dark. As they walk along the train tracks, a sickly Caleb tells May that he needs to go home. She's like, you won't get far, but okay. So Caleb stumbles to a bus depot where he attempts to purchase a ticket back home, but he's like $3 short of the fare. And the guy selling the tickets is zero help.
Yeah.
He buys a candy bar, but the taste of it is foul and he ends up spitting it out and it makes him retch a little bit. And then a detective approaches him and he believes Caleb is under the influence of drugs. And he's like, what are you on? And Caleb's like, you wouldn't believe me if I told you. Which is, I thought was good. He does end up giving Caleb the remaining money that he needs for his ticket. Unfortunately, Caleb doesn't last long on the bus and makes the bus driver stop and let him off early because he's too sick to continue. I guess this is the exception that proves the rule to ACAB. Like, one detective is a decent human being.
Yeah, I actually really like that little scene because he was like, you could tell like he was feeling like a lot of empathy for him. He's like, I'm going to give you this bus ticket, you know, or the money for the bus ticket, and I want you to go home to your family, you know, because he thought Caleb was strung out on drugs.
Yes. When he makes his way back to May, she feeds him her blood, which he drinks vigorously. He heals instantly from the wounds that he got, and the two run off together for the night. Meanwhile, unsatisfied with the police's efforts to find Caleb, Loy Colton sets out to find his son on his own with his daughter, Sarah. So they go around, they show Caleb's photos around gas stations along the highway, and they learn that the Winnebago they saw was found also along the highway, but it was torched with no bodies inside. That night, Caleb attempts to call home, but this is before cell phones, so he can't just call his dad. He calls the house, and no one is at the house, so there is no answer. May finds him and tells him that she wanted to go home once too, but she just had to embrace her new instincts, and he'll have to do the same. May then informs Caleb that he must learn to utilize his new instincts to kill in order to survive.
We then see a brief montage of the other members hunting. Homer uses his bicycle to lure Good Samaritans into pulling over to the side of the road, believing him to have been in an accident. A very slick-looking, dudded-up Severin hitchhikes and scores with two pretty girls in a truck. Meanwhile, lovebirds Jesse and Diamondback take on a hitchhiker, only to find that they're carjackers. Oh dear. I love the little moment between Jesse and Diamondback, reminiscing on how they met, that he had a flat tire and she pulled over to help him. I have a theory that this was on like Route 66 during the Depression, since Route 66 runs through Oklahoma and Kansas, and a lot of migration as well as American sightseeing happened during that time.
Yeah, I could see that. Also, this is why you don't hitchhike. Don't hitchhike. Or pick up hitchhikers, really. Either way, it's very dangerous.
I mean, if they turn me into a vampire.
Yeah, but that's not what they're doing.
Right. While researching for this episode, I learned more backstory, though, about the vampires. For the role, Lance Henriksen got acrylic nails himself and went at them with a pair of pliers to make them look monstrous and otherworldly. Oh, he nice. Dropped down to 140 pounds and lost a lot of muscle mass to take on that really gaunt look, but he threw out his back doing this, so don't starve yourself, kids. That is not okay. He decided that his character Jesse was in the Confederate States Navy and that he was in a sea skirmish on the Delaware River, lost, and as the ship was drifting and all of the men were dying, harpies started to feed on the dead men. A harpy took pity on Jesse Hooker and turned him. He brought this backstory to Catherine Bigelow, and she loved the backstory and sanctioned it. The story is then that Severin was supposed to be a victim of Jesse's, but he looks like the kid brother that Jesse lost during the Civil War, and thus he turned him. Jeanette's Diamondback was a Depression-era, Dust Bowl-era woman, as predicted by me, and Homer was turned in the 1950s, and they likely had no idea that he would continue to psychologically mature, because he was meant to be Jesse and Diamondback's child. Like, forever child.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So that is their stories.
Oh, cool. So despite claiming that he's not a killer, May and Caleb seek out a truck driver for his first attempt to kill. However, Caleb cannot follow through, so May kills for him. She then allows Caleb to drink from her instead, but warns that if he drinks too much from her, he could kill her. So it can't be like a constant thing. You're going to need to kill and drink from a human buddy at some point, is the point of that. We then return to Loy and Sarah, who were in Waco, Texas, still on the hunt for Caleb. Loy rings the sheriff back home to see if there's any news. He learns that there was a positive ID made on Caleb in Hope, Kansas, by a cop who sent Caleb home on a bus. So Loy decides to turn around and head back towards home because he thinks maybe Caleb is going back home. After a week, Caleb has yet to kill, and the gang is ready to kill him, deciding that he has not proved himself worthy to be a vampire or with them. But May convinces Jesse to give him one last night. Diamondback and Severin make it crystal clear that Caleb will die a long, suffering death if he does not conform and make his first kill that night.
We are then treated to the iconic shot of the gang peering down a hillside as the backlit moon and fog bathe over them. And it is the perfect moment to give a shout out to the director of photography, Adam Greenberg. Greenberg hit pay dirt with The Terminator and was subsequently in high demand. He had many scripts to pick from, but Near Dark is what got his attention. The cinematography for Near Dark is stunning. Every shadow, beam of light, soft filter, or angle was masterful. Bigelow needed someone like Greenberg to really capture this film, especially since it was mostly night shoots. So he knew exactly how to light it.
And that's important at night, because if it's really dark and you can't see, then it's hard to watch.
Yeah. So in what can only be described as the most iconic scene of the film, the vampire gang goes to a rough shit-kicker bar, and immediately Severin starts trouble with the patron at the bar. The bartender warns the ill-behaved man that there are two ways out of the bar, on his feet or on his back. Caleb tries to weasel away, only to have Severin pull him back and use him as a shield when the patron he was fucking with gets fed up enough to raise his fists. Caleb hits back, and the man goes flying across the bar and onto the pool table. The other vampires chuckle from the booth they are sharing. The cocktail waitress comes over to deliver their orders, with Jesse grabbing her and holding her close before Diamondback whips out her butterfly knife and slits the waitress's throat and empties her blood into a beer glass. Jesse shuts the bar door as Severin begins to howl and dance to the tune on the jukebox. He proceeds to kill a biker and then drinks his blood before declaring, "Finger licking good." The bartender, who had been slyly loading his shotgun, suddenly takes aim and blows a hole in Caleb's guts. He is shocked, but the wound is clearly healing quickly. Severin hops on the bar and proceeds to kill the bartender with his spurs. The patron, who had been knocked out cold on the pool table, rouses and limps towards the exit. Diamondback approaches him and claims, "There's a fly on the ceiling." When he inevitably looks upward, Homer shoots the man dead. There is only one patron left in the bar, a young man around Caleb's age. Jesse motions for Caleb to go for him. May gets up and walks over to the scared fella, urging him to dance with her. Caleb slowly rises and approaches the duo. May tells him that the boy is for him, but the mortal shouts in protest before throwing himself out a window and running off into the night. Caleb pursues him as the others torch the bar.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, this scene, I was like, man, I would not want to be a vampire stuck with these vampires at all. Like, I think I find Severin and Homer incredibly irritating, actually. So I do not enjoy their antics in any way. But also, I was just like, if the whole point was that Caleb needed to kill, I feel like, I don't know, they just go in and make a spectacle and like shoot and stab people. And I'm just like, I feel like they could have prioritized getting Caleb to kill a little bit better. But maybe they don't want to. Maybe they're looking for an excuse to get rid of him, so they don't really care. I don't know.
Caleb catches the young man, who begs for his life. Caleb allows him to escape just before the vampires drive up in a freshly stolen van and pull Caleb inside. An infuriated Jesse knows Caleb's would-be victim will go to the police, but as the sun is rising, the gang must quickly black out the van and seek shelter in a nearby motel. Jesse wakes up the proprietor and demands to rent one of the bungalows. Bleary-eyed, the elderly hotelier recognizes Jesse, who grins maniacally and says, yes, he comes along that way once every 50 years. And this is such an amazing little scene because of the shot as Jesse watches the sun creep up along the counter, getting closer and closer as he steps deeper into the shadow of, you know, the reception area. He takes the room key by wrapping his hand in his scarf so as not to like expose his skin.
Yeah.
So I thought that was just fucking brilliant, you know?
Yeah, it was definitely a good scene. And I like that the hotel proprietor like recognizes him and he's yeah. just like smiles. He's like, yep.
honestly, yeah, I know. His little grin.
Shouldn't have said anything, really. Not that it matters, but you know.
Right.
Sometime that day, the vampires are rudely awoken by the police who have surrounded the motel. As predicted, Caleb's intended victim is sitting in the back seat of one of the police cars, so he did not just run and go home. He ran for help, which is a smart move, but still not good for them. Vulnerable and terrified of the daylight, the gang tries to shoot it out. On the final countdown, Severn declares that it's checkout time and takes the first shot, blowing a hole right through a cop's chest. During the gunfight, Caleb risks his life to make his way to the van and gets the van. He like drives it right into the bungalow so that they can all pile in without being in the sun, and basically saves the day. Mm-hmm. Very good. I mean, it's a good thing that they let Caleb live so far because he saved their butts.
I mean, yeah. Also, the prosthetics for the scalded skin that Adrian wears in this scene as he's running to the van had hundreds of little pinpricks connected to tubes, which led to a device strapped to Caleb's stomach, or Adrian's stomach, with lit cigars.
Oh, wow.
So the smoke is cigar smoke, and the nicotine juice would collect between his skin and the prosthetic. And Adrian said that he stunk like a cigar for over a week, which, ugh, gross.
Yeah, ew.
Free from the police, the gang switches vehicles and heads to a new town where they check into the Godspeed Motel. The vampires are delighted with Caleb's actions. Diamondback praises him, Homer gives him a deserved handshake, and Severn gifts Caleb with one of his spurs. And Jesse gives Caleb more time to prove himself. Caleb inquires about Jesse's age, and the vampire leader reveals that when he was mortal, he fought for the South in the Civil War. Caleb and May then leave to enjoy the night while the rest stay in to play cards.
Yeah. I guess they have to be old Southern boys, but I'm like, of course he fought for the South. Like, come on.
I mean, people did. So
yes, a lot of them did. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's an episode of the X-Files where we learn about like Mulder's past life supposedly, and of course like he also fought for the South, and I'm like, why does everyone always fight for the South on these things? Like,
right. Yeah. Yeah, that one bothered me. This one doesn't bother me.
Makes sense for the character, but still it's just like, oh, of course.
Yes. Yeah. As they canoodle under the night sky, May reveals that she was turned 4 years prior when she was still in high school, and Homer told her he was a fifth grader in need of help with his homework. Clever. May does not recall what daylight is like any longer and asks Caleb if he misses it, but he says, nah, he sees better at night anyway.
Nice. So back at the motel, after Severin is caught cheating at cards, Homer folds and decides to go for a walk and enjoy a cigarette. Diamondback warns him to mind the time because it's nearly sunup. Homer hears the familiar clang of coins into a vending machine, so he sees a little girl there, and the little girl is Caleb's sister, Sarah. So Homer looks like he's about her age, so he convinces her to go watch television with him. And Sarah's pretty cool. I like her a lot. She's kind of like, I do what I want. I go where I want. I'm like, good for you. He brings Sarah up to his room, and she's like, wow, you all stay up really late. And the rest of the gang is kind of bemused, and Diamondback sends Severin to fetch Sarah's father in room 3 because they realize, like, oh, if we're going to do anything with this kid, like, we need to take care of the parents, too. The TV station goes off, prompting Sarah to want to head back to her room, so she opens the door and runs right into Caleb. So the first time I watched this, I was like, isn't this kid supposed to be, like, 50 years old mentally? Why is he fucking with another kid? Like, leave the kid alone. But then I started thinking about it, and I'm like, well, he's probably upset about May and realizes that, like, maybe he could use someone who is around his age forever. I don't know. But I still was just kind of like, what are you doing?
Yeah, like, I think he's caught between, like, a rock and a hard place. Like, he still behaves like a child sometimes out of habit or attention. And I think he knows that even a teenager like May would not be interested in him because of his physical form. So he has to go for a girl near his physical age so she will be, you know, stuck like him.
Yeah, that makes sense. But the first time I watched it, I was like, what the fuck, dude?
Right.
You made this big deal about how you're, like, an adult stuck in a kid's body. So, like, what are you doing? So Sarah and Caleb hug, and Caleb explains their connection to the vampires just as Severin returns with Loy. Caleb tells his family that he won't return with them and then asks Jesse to let them go. However, Homer physically restrains Sarah and announces that he's going to turn her as vengeance for May rejecting him and turning Caleb. Jesse believes the right course of action is to kill Loy because he's been tracking them and has seen their faces, so he could be future trouble. He's not just going to go home quietly and let this go. But Loy, who's had enough of this bullshit, pulls a gun and shoots Jesse. Unfortunately for him, Jesse is a vampire, and it doesn't do much. He basically coughs up the bullet and puts it in Loy's pocket. Sarah wriggles free from Homer and opens the door, and sunlight pours in. And while the vampires struggle to hide themselves from the light, the family escapes with Caleb wrapped in a blanket.
As they escape in Loy's truck, Caleb explains that he is no longer a person and does not know what to do. Loy wants to take his son to the hospital, but Caleb demonstrates his sun allergy and explains that he was bit. It is something to do with blood. As Caleb eyes his father's livestock vet equipment, he asks his father if he has ever given a blood transfusion to a human. Once they return home, Loy tests his son's theory and gives Caleb a blood transfusion with himself as the donor. The process cures Caleb, who eagerly takes to the sunlight with Sarah.
Yeah, I was, again, this is, I was making notes as I was watching because I had never seen this movie. And so I was wondering if the fact that he had never killed is what allowed the blood transfusion to work. Like, he hadn't fully transformed into a vampire because he hadn't taken that final step. It's entirely because there is an episode of Supernatural where Dean turns into a vampire. And there is a cure for vampirism in their world, but it has to be administered before the vampire kills. If the vampire kills somebody, the cure won't work. So,
and same with Lost Boys.
Yeah, yeah, I guess that's true as well. Once you killed, the transformation's complete. So, I mean, it's not like Supernatural invented that vampire lore. It's just where I mostly know it from. So I was like, I wonder if it's like Dean from Supernatural. Because, yeah, we will learn at the end of the movie that that is not the case. But I thought maybe that was where they were going.
So a little time goes by, and we see Caleb enjoying dinner with his family. After Sarah goes to prepare for bed, Caleb hears a squeaky swing and goes to investigate. He finds May and flinches when she approaches him. She asks why he left, and he tells her that he belongs at home with his family, but he misses her. May is startled to discover that Caleb is warm and alive again and takes off into the night. So during pre-production, Oklahoma, where they initially were going to film this, had a massive, unprecedented rainstorm that caused flooding, and they lost all of their locations for filming. They were forced to relocate to Arizona and experienced the first known freak snow at night in July.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So the night shoots were incredibly grueling and taxing on the cast and crew. They lived in a tiny motel behind the locations, and Jeanette Goldstein said that it was really a challenge for her to get out of character because the only people around were cast and crew. So, and for this scene in particular, to get rid of the breath that Jenny and Adrian would produce during these freezing desert night shoots, they had to hold ice cubes in their mouth right before saying their lines.
Oh, yikes.
Yeah. So like the movie and the filming took place in summer, but it was just really cold at night in Arizona.
Yeah. And deserts get cold at night. People don't think about it, but it usually doesn't snow in July. Although, yeah, I mean, I grew up in Lake Tahoe and sometimes it would snow in like May or June or July. So you just never know. It's kind of unpredictable.
But... yeah. I'm assuming like it must have been like northern Arizona, but who knows, you know?
Yeah. Definitely probably not a normal snowstorm, but still.
No. It was like a freak snowstorm that they had. It was weird. So Caleb goes back inside the house and finds Sarah missing. Discovering his truck tires slashed, Caleb pursues the vampires on horseback. In town, the horse bucks Caleb as Severin comes upon them. Following a brief beating from Severin, Caleb waves down an approaching 18-wheeler. Severin shoots the driver, but Caleb uses the truck to run down Severin. However, Severin survives, climbs up the hood, and begins ripping the engine out with his bare hands. Caleb brakes, causing the trailer to crash into the cab, and bails out just before the vehicle explodes, leaving nothing behind of Severin except for a single spur.
Fuck yeah. I did not like that guy. I was not sad to see him go. I was like, yes, get him. Get him. With Severin gone, Jesse emerges to finish off Caleb. Well, Caleb questions Jesse about the whereabouts of Sarah. Diamondback sneaks up behind him. Sarah is struggling against Homer and manages to get her hand around the base of a heavy flashlight and smack him in the head. Diamondback readies the knife to throw at Caleb's back, but Sarah emerges and screams, warning Caleb, and he ducks and the knife strikes Jesse directly in the mouth. Of course, it doesn't, you know, do too much damage, but still, didn't hurt Caleb either. Caleb grabs Sarah and runs, and Diamondback pretends to let them go so Jesse can gun them down. However, May knocks Jesse aside and he misses the shot. Good for May. May, girl, you don't need these jerks. You'll be fine. You don't need them. The gang chases down the siblings, snatching Sarah and driving off while frantically prepping the vehicle for the rising sun. In the middle of the chaos, May rips Sarah from Homer's grasp and jumps out of the car. Smoldering in the sunlight, May runs with Sarah towards the approaching Caleb. Homer follows, but quickly explodes in the sunlight because he did not have any protection. Jesse and Diamondback drive towards Caleb and Sarah, who surround a blanketed May, intent on running down the three. However, before they can get very far, the sunlight comes through the window and Jesse and Diamondback burn up, and the car rolls harmlessly off the road as it explodes from within. Vampires in this universe literally like explode into flame. It's pretty crazy. I kind of dig it, actually. Later, May wakes during daylight and finds that Caleb has given her a blood transfusion, curing her. When she tells him that she's afraid, he embraces her and replies, "Don't be. It's just the sun." So, yeah, I was like, oh, okay, I guess killing has nothing to do with it. It's just the blood transfusion works, I guess. That's cool. I really wanted May and Caleb to run off and be vampires happily alone without the others. I guess this ending, it makes sense for the story, but I was like, eh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, in an earlier draft of the script, the film ended with May and Caleb enjoying the morning sun and Sarah leaping off the porch to join them, but she yelps in pain and leaps back onto the porch to watch as her skin begins to smolder. I'm glad they didn't end the film like that, mostly because they solved vampirism, so it would not matter if Sarah is a vampire or not.
Yeah, it wouldn't make any sense because it's like they would just cure her, so it doesn't matter. Yeah. Yeah. So the vampire lore in this movie is pretty solid. Obviously, the vampires must hunt or drink blood. If they don't, they start to get kind of sick. The turning process is started by a vampire bite, and I think it's finished by drinking vampire blood. I wasn't entirely clear because he's like half turned when he runs away to the bus, and then he comes back and drinks May's blood. So I don't know if he was already fully a vampire or if drinking her blood finished the process.
I'm not sure. Yeah, that's not very clear.
They can drink from other vampires, but they can kill them if they drink too much, so they can't just drink from other vampires, and they have to be careful about it.
Mm-hmm.
They must avoid sunlight, or they burst into flame and literally explode. So, gotta stay out of the sun.
There's a lot of smoldering first.
There is, but there's an explosion. It's not just, like, burst into flame and burn. It is, like, an actual explosion.
Yeah.
And they can heal from wounds, including gunshot wounds.
You know, I actually wonder if, like, the older the vampire, the more easily flammable they are. Because I noticed that May and Caleb smolder a lot.
Oh, yeah, yeah, maybe.
You know what I mean? Like, they're fresh vampires, but, like, Homer was aflame for, like, very briefly before he exploded. And same with Jesse and Diamondback. So yeah. I'm wondering if that's kind of part of it. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Kind of like the opposite of what I find a lot of vampire lore to be, you know, which is like the older you are, the more, not immune, but like the harder it is for the sun.
Yeah, the longer it takes.
Yeah. So,
unless
but
you're
like
Lestat, and then you can just sunbathe in the desert and it doesn't kill you.
You just fly right into the sun.
Sure. I mean, it's not quite like that, but yeah. Oh, dear.
I want to talk about a couple of themes that I noticed. There's so much going on in this film, and so it's difficult to unpack it all. So I'm just going to list the themes that really jumped out to me.
Sure.
First was inverting gender roles within a Western trope. So at the beginning, Caleb remains fairly gentlemanly with May until he pulls over the truck and tries to coerce physical intimacy from her. It's like every woman's nightmare is being put in this sort of situation. And it was just really shitty of him. Mm-hmm. But May flips the tables and she becomes the predator, biting him before running off. So she is the one who initiates him into vampirism without consent, instead of him forcing her to do anything without consent, mm-hmm. you know? Also, in Westerns, it is usually women and children who are kidnapped by the bad guys, mm-hmm. but in Near Dark, it is Caleb. He's the one being pressured to assimilate into a new culture, one that goes against his own moral fiber and humanity. So he has to become rescued. And he is when May physically puts herself between him and Severin. While Caleb does end up having his heroic moment at the end, it is May and Sarah who ultimately rescue themselves and get to Caleb, mm-hmm. you know, of their own volition. Because Sarah, she is small, but man, she is a little badass.
Yeah, she really is. I like her a lot.
Yeah, like she's the one who freed herself from Homer twice, you know? So, mm-hmm. yeah. Two, redefining the nuclear family. I find it absolutely fascinating that the vampires form more of a quote unquote complete family than Caleb and his family, which consists of a single father and a little sister, no mother, and no mention of the mother. Whereas the vampires have a father in Jesse, a mother in Diamondback, children in May and Homer, and Severin kind of oscillates between brother or son to Jesse. And now here comes May bringing home her boyfriend. This is like a gorier version of Meet the Parents. Obviously, the vampire family is anything but traditional, as they do not conform to like the Reagan era definition of the all-American family. So it kind of subverts it and those expectations.
Sure.
And finally, overcoming trauma. I used to really dislike the ending because I love vampirism and I want to almost always root for them. The transfusion as a cure for vampirism seemed like such a pallid choice, but after reading an essay by LaDonna Petra, link in the notes, I have been converted. The transfusion symbolizes overcoming horrific ordeals and trauma. I might add that it is Caleb's father who administers and provides the needed blood. This is the literal lifeblood Caleb needed, that of his family's. I definitely prefer this more hopeful interpretation also than like the tired drug addiction allegory, or at least if one were to combine them, it could give the viewer hope after overcoming a vicious ordeal, a life of peace and happiness after recovery. You know, there's a lot of like ways you can interpret the symbolism and the allegories there. And I choose to ignore the negative ones and go for the more like, oh, I see that, you know, like that's pretty good, because you know how like you had a pretty visceral negative reaction to like Severin, you know, in particular, you know, he's the most violent.
Yeah, I just thought he was a douchebag, to be honest.
And he's a douchebag, right? Like, he's
and Homer too. Homer kind of, yeah. I thought was a douchebag. I'm like, I don't like you guys. I wouldn't want to hang out with you.
Right.
So, would not want to be part of this vampire gang. I would be out of there as fast as I could. So.
Right. Right. So, you know, and they're trying to like force Caleb into like this new way of living, you know, of unrepented violence. And he just doesn't want to do it.
Yeah, he doesn't. He doesn't want to be a vampire. He does not want to kill. So the ending is a happy ending for him and May, because even May seemed like maybe she wasn't satisfied with the way things were going.
So. Right, because she sought out someone like Caleb.
Yeah.
You know, where she could have easily just killed him. And I have a funny feeling if she hadn't been on her own, she probably would have.
Yeah, if she'd been with the others, for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I did see something in your notes that it got deleted, but I did see something about how like someone said the ending was a cop out. So I was just curious if that was referring to like May and Caleb becoming human again, or if it's referring to how easily Jesse and Diamondback are kind of defeated. Like I didn't know which part they were saying was the cop out.
I don't know for certain.
Okay.
But I'm assuming it was. So, okay, so the quote or like that reference in question was an early critic review from 1987. And even in the essay that I then quote from by LaDonna, she referenced it in conjunction with Caleb and May reverting back to humanity.
Okay, okay.
Yeah,
I was just curious because I kind of felt like they were easily burned up and it was kind of a cop out. I felt like the ending was a little too abrupt, I guess, is what I felt like that final battle. And I kind of get it because they didn't finish like sunproofing the car. Like it makes sense. But I was just, I don't know. I felt like it was weird. The whole ending part was weird because they kind of like look at each other and decide to drive towards them. But like, it doesn't feel like a Thelma and Louise suicide drive. And yet they haven't done anything to block the sun, so it seems like they know, like, they're going to start, they do start smoking. Like, it just, for me, felt kind of odd. Like, I just didn't understand that choice, I guess. I didn't get why Jesse and Diamondback did what they did, and so that kind of threw me off a little bit.
Yeah, I think the obsessiveness that Jesse had towards going and really gunning after Caleb is supposed to be, like, seen as a self-destructive behavior.
Yeah,
like obsessively, you know, going after him, because he could have just let him just
they could have just, you know, finished sunproofing the car and driven off and maybe tried to go after them later or something. I guess that's, I was just kind of like, I didn't really understand.
I don't know. I think it was because, like, you know, because Severin and Homer, you know, were gone, and it's like, well, we've lost our family.
Sure.
And because I mean, the last line you hear is Diamondback, you know, kind of in resignation, she smiles and she just says, fun times, you know?
Yeah, I guess I just didn't quite understand what I was supposed to take from that, because they do like exchange a look and I'm like, I didn't really know what to think.
Right. Yeah. They gave up.
I guess so.
Yeah. Because, right, I felt like they did give up. That's the thing. They did.
Sure.
I feel like if they had been speeding down the road, and then like the sun caught them and they, you know, exploded and stuff, that would have made a lot of sense.
Sure.
You know, but like they 100% gave up.
Yeah.
In those final minutes.
Yeah.
So I just think like they were just like, fuck it. It's time.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
That makes sense. I was just curious if that was the problem that the reviewer had, or if it was about them turning human, which also like... human. We literally just talked about that in our last episode. And, you know, that's not my favorite thing either. Obviously, I would prefer they stay vampires. It does work for this story. Like, I think the story they were telling. It makes sense. I totally get it. Obviously, it's not the kind of vampire story I would write. But, like, that's fine. That doesn't mean anything.
Right. And it works in Lost Boys, too. You know? I mean, am I happy about that? No. But that's okay.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it is just, I mean, I could see why you would feel like it's a cop out, because it's just kind of easy. But I do think the film does a good job of establishing, you know, the script is very solid for this movie. Like everything is set up and established. Nothing comes out of the blue to the point where you're like, that doesn't make sense in the world we're given.
No.
Like it all fits. Like we learn that his father is a vet. We learn that his father, you know, works with animals and does like, you know, injections and stuff. So he's going to have this kind of equipment. And then obviously they do it to Caleb and it works. So obviously it's going to work with May. Like none of it doesn't make sense. It all comes together very well.
Yeah. And the thing about Kathryn Bigelow, what I've really learned about doing research for this is that she is a very artsy fartsy person.
Sure.
So everything in this movie is very intentional.
Yeah.
And fraught with like themes and tropes and symbolism, and there's nothing that's a throwaway. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So whether I catch on to it or not, or pinpoint her exact intention, I don't think matters. But I do know that after really doing research, it was just not a cop-out. You know, nothing was a cop-out. I have actually much more profound appreciation for this film.
Sure.
After doing this big deep dive for it.
Yeah.
So Tori, what are your final thoughts on Near Dark?
I think it's an objectively good movie. I think the script is very solid. I think if I were studying this film in film school or something, like, it works. It works completely. Nothing about it doesn't work. It's not my favorite. I'm sorry.
No.
I wanted to like it a lot. It's just not my... I mean, I'm not really into Westerns either. And like, just vampires with guns and knives. And like, I'm like, okay, sure. But again, it's just not my brand of vampire. And I don't have a problem with like roaming around in an RV. And like, I think the story is really solid. It's good. I think it's the kind of movie you should definitely see at least once. Like, I think it works. I just, mm-hmm. I think I was so irritated by Severin and Homer, and then I just wasn't into like the guns and like the little lines, like the little one-liners that Severin's throwing out. I'm just like, oh, okay, I get it. You're like the bad, you think you're a badass, like whatever. I did really like Caleb and May. I really did. And I thought May was really cool. And like immediately, like the opening of the movie, when you first see her, she does look like pale and otherworldly, and she's holding an ice cream cone, and you're like, she's not eating that. Like, she's a vampire. And then she starts to like joke around with Caleb and, you know, hone in on those words like die, like I would kill for that, or I would die for that, or whatever. Like, I just thought the whole opening was really, really good. And then she finally bites him, and you're like, yeah, okay, I knew that was coming. I knew exactly where this was going. And I like Jesse and Diamondback a lot. I thought they were interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, I mean, it's the kind of movie that I'm glad I watched it. I enjoyed watching it. It wasn't like sitting through it was awful or anything. I did enjoy it. I thought it was fun. It's not the kind of movie I would probably watch again.
Right, right.
But I'm glad to have seen it and now have that reference. So at least now I know what Near Dark is about.
Yeah. Yeah, this one is definitely in my favorite vampire film cabinet.
Sure, sure.
I have a lot of love in my heart for it. Thing, probably because my roots, as you know, are in the South, like on my dad's side, and I drove across the country twice with my mom as a child. So like those long stretches of like barren highway,
mm-hmm.
really like they are very nostalgic for me.
Sure.
And especially at night or at dawn. So that brings back like those kinds of memories. The fact that like it's a vampire family, even as fucked up as they are.
Sure.
You know, I mean, my favorite character initially when I was younger and I saw this was Diamondback.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to know everything about her. First of all, it was Jeanette Goldstein. And I was just like, because she's very fine. She is my brand of hot milk. And there was just always like this mystery to her that I really appreciated. I used to not like Caleb, and I, as an adult, I really like Caleb now.
Yeah, I think it's interesting how like certain stories or whatever, as you experience them at different points in your life, you relate to different people and you see different aspects of it. Like, I really liked Caleb and May, and I'm generally not a fan of the character who like doesn't want to be a vampire, but obviously like that's kind of the story.
No, he was very compelling.
He was. He's obviously the protagonist, and like May I thought was very compelling. Like, I really liked her story. I liked that she'd only been a vampire for a couple years and was clearly... she was on the low rung of the ladder with the group. Like, she is, you know, the newbie, and she's having to beg for them not to kill this guy that she likes and wants
to be. But you can tell they have like genuine affection for her too, because they want to, you know, because they're like, Jesse treats her like, okay, this is my teenage daughter, you know, and I'm, you know, I'm trying to give her a shot at independence with this, bringing this boyfriend into the gang. All right, you know, and, I don't know, like their dynamic with May is very interesting. And Severin, like, I feel like with Severin, you would think like, just like in your head, right? Like, oh, well, maybe Severin would be jealous, right? Over like May. No, he's not. Like, he definitely treats her like a younger sister, you know, like there's no the person that he has the rivalry with May's affection, it mildly, is Homer, who's just sort of like, you know, bitter about everything because he's a bitter old dude, which fair to him, you know?
Yeah.
Severn's an interesting character, and he's one that's very much like glorified a lot in like vampire communities and such because, you know, he's because of his like comedic violence. I do feel like Severn is a very freeing character because he's just so unapologetically like vampire, you know, like predator. But then that also kind of makes him a little one-dimensional because of that.
Yeah, a little bit.
So, yeah, I just, it's like, it leaves me satisfied with like the film as a whole. Like, I don't ever want a fucking sequel or a prequel or anything like that.
Right.
Or remake, you know, I don't need that, but it has still, it keeps me burning with like curiosity to like fill in the blanks, you know, like, ooh, you know, like they're interesting. So, and I think that's kind of why I keep coming back to it. And honestly, it's a mellow enough movie that I can have it on in the background and do other shit, you know?
Yeah, totally. I can see that.
Yeah, like I'm not gonna, I'll be pulled into like my favorite scenes or whatever, and then like I can go about like doing my cross stitch or whatever the hell I'm doing.
Yeah, I do think the idea of vampires roaming around road tripping in an RV is like brilliant. And I would love to see someone else take that on and make like another vampires in an RV thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that would be really fun. I really like that as a concept. Kind of reminds me of the movie Paul, where they're like road tripping around with the alien, but like, you know, it could just be vampires. I think that can be really fun. You could do a lot with it, just in terms of like, you know, you've got this mobile house that you can block out the windows and go, and it just, yeah, I think that's cool.
Yeah, especially like if you set it now or something, like sure, with all yeah. the tech and stuff that's around.
Yeah, you could definitely do a lot. You could do a lot of things, so it could be fun. So I think that's a really cool concept.
Yeah. I would recommend Near Dark if you're a fan of indie films, especially ones that explore vampires as and vampirism as allegories for like bigger picture stuff. And also if you're a fan of genre films, especially fusion genre films. So if you like the concept of horror and Western, you know, meeting together at an intersection and having a baby, this is definitely then the film for you to give a go. Good luck finding it. Sometimes it's streaming, sometimes it's not. It's one of those that you kind of have to hunt for sometimes.
Yeah, we actually, my co-host of my other podcast had it on DVD and he ripped the DVD for us because we could not find it anywhere. I even tried to like buy it on iTunes and stuff. You can't buy it digitally, and I do not own a DVD player at this moment or a computer with a CD drive, so I may have to get a DVD player at some point. But yeah, so that was how we found it. I will say, I think it's a fun movie. I think it's a fun like 80s popcorn movie, and by popcorn I mean literally sit on your couch with a bucket of popcorn and turn it on. I think it's a fun time. I think if you're looking for just a fun vampire movie that you haven't seen yet and you haven't watched it, I would definitely recommend just seeing it once and checking it out, because I do think it is a solid film just in terms of filmmaking, and I think it's entertaining for sure. It's not like my favorite vampire world where I'm gonna go like try and find fanfic on AO3 or anything.
But,
yeah, and that's fine. See, everyone's got their own. I'm for me, it's very much a movie that I watched it. I'm glad that I've seen it now, and like now I'm good. Like I don't need anything else from it. But
I do believe Shudder is streaming it. So if you do have Shudder, Near Dark is there.
Sure. But yeah, it's definitely fun. It was fun to watch. Thank you for inspiring me to finally watch it. There's a lot of vampire movies that I just for some reason have never seen. I don't know why. There's a huge gap in my vampire movie viewing history, so I'm glad to kind of fill that in with this podcast.
That's okay, because you're filling in the blanks for me for books.
Yeah, there's a lot of vampire books that I really like. we will get to some of those in the future. Yep. We've gotten to some of, I mean, Let the Right One In is one of those, and we've talked about that, but we will get to some more of them as we progress. But thank you so much for listening to our discussion of Near Dark. As always, you can hit us up on social media and let us know what you think of Near Dark. And if you want to hear me talk more about Lance Henriksen, you can check out I Want to Rewatch. I will also link to that in the show notes. And we do Millennium Mondays. So almost every Monday, there is an episode of Millennium Season 1, at least for now.
Thank you.
Bye.
This is Tori and Chell wishing you a fantabulous evening with vampire wishes and batty nightmares.
This podcast was edited by me, Tori. Our music is edited and mixed by Vikra the Never Living and includes Dark Halloween Night by Chase Allen Willis and Toccata and Fugue in D minor by Johann Sebastian Bach, performed by Kevin MacLeod.
Thank you for listening. Please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you really want to join our hellish crusade, please leave us 5 stars on Apple and Spotify. Be sure to tell your favorite blood-sucking fiends about vampires ruined my life.